Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 231, and it is February 28th. And next time, it's going to be March 1st, I believe. No, next time will be March 2nd already. Yeah, today's the 28th, and today's the last day of the month. All right, so let's take a look. The sign-in sheet is going around. Today, we are going to cover joints. So we're done talking about most of the bones, unless somebody has a question on bones. And let's see. Okay. When is your lecture test in here? I thought I had a syllabus. March 9th. So it's a week from Wednesday. So it's a week and a half away. But there is a test this week. What's happening this week? Lab practicums start this week. So not today. Those of you who have lab today, that's your last lab before the practicum. But Wednesday's group, the lab practicum starts, and remember, it's going to cover Unit 2, which is labs 3, 4, and 5, but we also have to go back and pick up something from lab number 2, which is the integument model. And some people ask me, how do you prepare for that? Well, the display case up on the third floor right outside the anatomy room has the integument model with all the possible questions with a number, so if you can answer all those numbers on that model, then that's 100% on that part of the practicum. The other thing, if you go into Blackboard, so here's Blackboard right here, go under Course Documents, click Course Documents. There are a number of different videos that you can watch, including three on the integument. One is epidermis, one is dermis, and the other is accessory structure. So you can look over that. And if you have a question on how to label the structures in the display case, you can look at the videos to see exactly how they should be numbered. All right, so I think that's really kind of perfect help for you to do that. So what else did I put in Blackboard? Lecture recordings. Here's a link to lecture recordings also on this website. Here it is right here. Maybe I'm going to open in a new window. Where's new window? Here's new window right here. All right, here is a video on a picture that's very similar to the integument model that you might have on the lecture test. This is for a Bio 160 class. It's a little bit lower level, but I think that should help you a lot. And then here is a video on the disarticulated bones of the skull that you can practice understanding how the disarticulated bones look. All right, so what you probably want to do with these is right-click and then save the target as, save link as to someplace on your hard drive so you don't have to have internet access every time you want to look at it. And that will help you out. So download those, look at those videos. The best way to look at those videos is on a DVX player. Windows Media Player should work, Real Player should work, QuickTime should work, but every once in a while, if you haven't updated your players recently, you might get the audio track but not the video, or you might get the video track and not the audio, which is very dissatisfying. So go into Course Documents, look at Plugins. Do I have plugins anywhere? Plugins. Course information. Look in course information. Plugins. Here's the link for that DVX player, and it has always worked for me. I've never run into a student that had one track but not the other. So just have an icon on your desktop if you wish, or in a folder someplace with a downloaded video file that you have. You know, just grab it and drag and drop it onto that icon, and it should automatically then open up and play. And the DVX is really nice because it can play all kinds of HD videos as well. So you should probably be aware of that. It does not take a lot of computer resources. And then here's a link to the study room up on the third floor. And I'm supposed to be there 9:30 to 10:30 on Tuesdays and Thursdays, but tomorrow I got to cut out a little bit early. But it's going to be a crucial time because you have your practicums coming up, and that's where you can actually look at the bones once again and actually have in your hands the integument model. So come by during these times. All right, so you, there's no phone, so you can't call to make sure that an instructor really is there when they should be there, but at least this is the schedule as we like to have it. Okay, and then, of course, here is the link to the lectures if you want them. All right, any questions on that? No. And then don't forget, on Blackboard, you have all kinds of really good drag and drop and interactive exercises from numerous websites to practice your bones. And I can't stress enough how important it is to know bones, because you're kind of familiar with bones. You kind of know what bones look like, right? Because you know what an arm looks like on you, and there's one bone in there, and you just get to know it, and that will help you with your vascular anatomy, muscle anatomy, neuroanatomy, a lot. So really study your bones well. It will make learning everything else in the class a lot easier to do that. All right, so let's start talking about joints. And we want to classify joints. So what the heck is a joint? Another name for a joint is articulation. I do have to turn some of these lights off. How about that one? No, that one I want on. But these I want off. Okay, can you see the screens a little bit better? Yeah, a little bit better. Okay, a joint is a site where two or more bones come together. And it doesn't necessarily have to move. A joint is just something where two bones come together. And sometimes it provides for motion, and other times it's a very stable joint that does not move. So we want to classify joints by a couple of different ways. One is by their function, that is, do they move or not, or how much they move. And then another classification is how are these joints made up? What's the composition of a joint? So one is a more physiologic or functional description of a joint, like how it moves or doesn't move, and the other is really an anatomic description, right? How are the joints actually physically put together? So we can talk about joints either by their structure or by their function, and sometimes we actually combine these different terms. We talk about a joint in terms of its structure as well as its function. All right, so in terms of a structural classification, I think maybe I'll turn that down just a little bit. In terms of a structural classification, we can see some joints are made out of what? Mostly fibers. Like what kind of fiber, if you were going to pick a fiber? Collagen is a perfect fiber, nice strong fiber. All right. Other joints are made out of cartilage, and that's not quite as strong a joint. All right. And then some are what we call synovial joints, and a synovial joint is pretty complex. It's got a number of different things. It's probably got 5 or 6 different features that we have to be aware of, right? And that's going to be an important exam figure too. You have to know the structure of a synovial joint. We can also classify joints by their function. And immovable joints are what we call synarthroses. Not movable. Maybe just a little tiny bit of motion can take place there, but basically you can think of them as immovable joints. And think of the skull. How many joints in the skull are actually movable? What's the one movable joint in the skull that is? The TMJ. And when I say TMJ, what does that mean? Temporomandibular joint, right? All the other joints are what we call immovable, but what do we call those immovable, the rest of the immovable joints in the skull? We call them sutures, right? And sutures are immovable joints, so a good example of a synarthrosis would be a suture. Those are the bones in the head. They move ever so slightly, but probably none of us in here have ever felt that. Some people can actually palpate motion of the joints of the skull, but it's very, very subtle, hardly moves whatsoever. Okay, the next kind of joint by functional classification is a joint that is slightly movable. For instance, the joints between the vertebrae, we call that an intervertebral joint. So you can actually bend forwards a little bit, you can bend backwards a little bit, those joints do move. You can rotate some of the joints just a little bit, but of course you can't turn your head completely all the way around, right, 360 degrees. So that's what we call an amphiarthrosis kind of joint. And then the last kind, by what? Function is what we call a diarthrosis. That's a freely movable joint. So a good example of that would be, for instance, the hip or the elbow. Those are freely movable. Those you can move when you contract skeletal muscle. Don't forget, skeletal muscle is a kind of muscle that's attached to your skeleton, and that's the only kind that you have voluntary control over. All right, so this is on increasing order of mobility, synarthrosis, diarthrosis, and amphiarthrosis and diarthrosis in that order. And if you take the first letter of each of these words right here, that spells something that might help you remember the correct order of movability. It is what? Sad. But it's a good thing that it's sad because it's easy to remember, right? If it was ADS or DSA or something like that, that wouldn't make any sense. So SAD at least can help you out a little bit. So the S in SAD stands for what kind of mobility? Synarthrosis, but what kind of mobility? Would be immobile. That's right. And the one in the middle, which is the A, or amphiarthrosis, is slightly movable. Right? And there you have an example of intervertebral joint that's slightly movable. And the freely movable one is what we call a diarthrosis. Okay. Well, let's go back up to the structural classification and look at some joints, all right, by their structural classification. So these are going to be fibrous joints. We did mention sutures as a kind of joint. All right, so let me boot up this slide over here. All right, so here we have a number of synarthrosis joints. These are all immovable joints, like what? Sutures that are in the skull. These are held together by dense fibrous connective tissue or a bone-to-bone connection. That's dense fibrous connective tissue is called what? Bone-to-bone is called a? As opposed to muscle-to-bone connection. Okay. Bone-to-bone is a ligament, and a muscle-to-bone connection, same kind of tissue, but we call it a tendon. All right, so muscle-to-bone is tendon, bone-to-bone is a ligament. All right, so there's a suture. Here's another kind of synarthrosis. It's called a syndesmosis, a joint held together by a ligament, and it's a little bit longer. So the talofibular joint between the talus, the tibia and the fibula right here, that's a ligament. That's an immovable joint, right? So you can't really move your foot backwards and forwards like you can your hand, right? So your radius and all it can move, but the joint between your tibia and fibula cannot. That's what we call a syndesmosis. And there is another ligament between a tooth and the alveolus, which is the socket that the root of the tooth fits into. All right, who can take a tooth out of that alveolus and put it back? No, it doesn't work, right? They're held in place by this, what we call periodontal ligament. What does peri mean? Peri means surrounding, and anytime you hear dental or dental or dentitia or dentist, what should you think? You should think something about teeth, right? So the periodontal ligament is the ligament that holds, all right, the root of the tooth into the alveolus, which is in what bones of the skull? What bones have alveoli? Mandible is one. What's another one? Maxilla. Yeah, your upper and lower jaw bones. And sometimes you might be eating something and you bite into just a little bit of a bone chip that you weren't prepared for, right? And your occlusion means your jaw bones don't come together just the right way, and it kind of twists a tooth just a little bit, ever so slightly, maybe not even a millimeter. Maybe just a fraction of a millimeter, but remember, it kind of twinges, it hurts really bad, and that's because all of a sudden you stretched out these little periodontal ligaments right here, and that hurts. Okay, and these are the things that get dissolved away when you lose your baby teeth. Okay, so that tooth just falls out. So all of these are immovable joints, and those are what we call, what kind of joints that are immovable? These are synarthroses. Right, so examples of synarthroses would be a suture, a syndesmosis, and a gomphosis. A gomphosis is what we call a peg and socket. It's another example of a fibrous joint. So up over here, I just put one example, but probably I should put these other two, syndesmoses and gomphoses, on this line right here as well. Okay, so syndesmoses. Ligaments, amount of movement varies, right? Between no motion right here between the fibula and tibia. But some, okay, are freely movable, like between the radius and the ulna, the interosseous membrane between the radius and the ulna. That is a freely movable joint. So what do we call a freely movable joint? That is a diarthrosis, right? So this chapter probably is maybe one of the most confusing of all the bone, of all the skeletal chapters, because you have to flip back and forth between what? Between a structural classification and functional classification. So just try to break it down into those two, and just remember SAD for a functional classification. All right, but what about a gomphosis? What kind of joint is that by function? It is immovable, right? It's a synarthrosis. So a gomphosis is a synarthrosis kind of joint. Okay, and that's by the periodontal ligament. All right, cartilaginous joints. Let's see what we have for cartilaginous joints right here. Oh, here are the individual ones. Okay. Cartilaginous joints, we can have two different kinds, a synchondrosis versus a symphysis. And bones are united by cartilage, right? In cartilaginous joints, or joint cavity is lacking. There's no cavity. There is just cartilage between two bones. For example, the epiphyseal plate, before it becomes ossified in pre-adolescent individuals, or we call this the growth plate, that is cartilage. Remember, it can be damaged very easily by what? Axial compression, or by tension, by pulling, or by rotation, some kind of torsion injury to the epiphyseal plate right here. That is also, that should also be an immovable joint. All right, so synchondrosis is immovable, at least this epiphyseal plate. Here is another one, the joint between the first rib and the sternum. That's another immovable joint. So that is what, a synarthrosis. But since it's made out of cartilage, synchondrosis right here is what, the structural classification, but synarthrosis is the functional classification for this joint right here. So synchondrosis, you should know as a structural classification, because anytime you hear chondro, what should you think of? A function or more of a structure? A structure, and that structure is cartilage. And so synchondrosis is a kind of structural joint that we call a cartilaginous joint. Right? So synchondrosis. All right, a symphysis is another kind of cartilaginous joint, but a different kind, not hyaline cartilage or articular cartilage, but fibrocartilage, can be slightly movable. Like the intervertebral discs are made out of fibrocartilage. So let's see if I have a slide of that. Oh, I do. All right, so here is a fibrocartilage sandwiched between two layers of hyaline cartilage, superiorly and inferiorly, and it's the annulus fibrosus, that is the fibrocartilage ring of an intervertebral disc, which is really tough. Right, and it prevents compressions of these vertebral bodies and keeps the spinal cord, the vertebral column pretty nice and healthy. All right, so that's a strong kind of cartilage, does not compress, but it is slightly movable. So it's a cartilaginous joint, and it's a symphysis, but by function, which kind is it? What were the three kinds of joints by function? It's sad, right? It's either Yeah, it is amphiarthrosis, but what were the three kinds of joints by function? Yes, the synarthrosis, amphiarthrosis, amphiarthrosis and diarthrosis. And since these are slightly movable, we call these what? Amphiarthroses joints, right? The other one is the pubic symphysis, slightly movable. At times in your life, sometimes it's more movable than other times, like during parturition. All right, then this joint dissolves away a little bit. And can you tell this is a nice female pelvis right here? Because the pubic arch is greater than 180 degrees. So I would say this is a good example of a female pelvis. This joint dissolves away so that the pelvic arch can separate and can rotate up a little bit. And it increases the size of what? The pelvic outlet for parturition. And then after birth, then the pubic bones kind of come back together, mostly. Okay. All depends. Okay, so we've talked about joints by their structure. Fibrous joints, cartilaginous joints. What's the last kind of joint by structure classification? A synovial joint, right? And all synovial joints, you're going to like this because it's really nice and simple in terms of its function. All synovial joints are diarthroses. All right, so every kind of synovial joint is freely movable. That's just the nature of a synovial joint. Not all diarthroses are synovial, but the other way around is certainly true. Okay, so synovial joints, a type of structural classification, are all diarthroses. So if you want to understand something about a synovial joint, which is a structural classification, you got to know something about the different structures that make up a synovial joint. So here are all the structures that you should know something about. Every synovial joint has articular cartilage. It has a joint cavity. Right? It has a joint capsule. It has synovial fluid and a synovial membrane. So this is a really important, it also has some reinforcing ligaments, some nerves and blood vessels. It might have a bursa and a tendon sheet around it. So let's see if we can find a typical kind of synovial joint. Ah, here's a good example right here. All right, figure 9.3 is a good example of a synovial joint. So here is the proximal bone. Here's the distal bone. These two bones join together. So what do we call a joint between two bones? What's another name for a joint between two bones called? Articulation, that's right. And remember, that articulation could be immovable, synarthrosis, could be amphiarthrosis if it's slightly movable, or diarthrosis if it's freely movable. And here's one that is freely movable, so this is a diarthrosis, but because it contains all these structures right here, this is also a synovial joint by structure. So what does a synovial joint have? To protect the ends of the bones, right? Now these bones are touching each other, but what else are they doing since it's a diarthrosis? They're moving, right? And so the ends of these bones have to be protected with hyaline cartilage. So that hyaline cartilage sometimes is what we call articular cartilage, but it is a type of hyaline, doesn't have many fibers in it. It's very smooth and slippery and can absorb some shock, but it protects the ends of the bone so they don't grind each other away, because don't remember that bones are kind of like a rock, sandpaper. They would grind each other down. So they're protected by this articular cartilage. And lubricating this articular cartilage is a fluid that's held in the space between these two bones. We call that synovial fluid. So it also nourishes the living cells in the hyaline cartilage right here, and sort of maintains the cartilage and also lubricates it. So synovial fluid. The synovial fluid comes from the synovial membrane, which is the deep membrane right here that forms the joint cavity. So here's the cavity. What does the cavity have in it? It has a fluid. What did we call that fluid? Synovial fluid, because this is a synovial joint, which is a freely movable joint. So the synovial fluid comes from the synovial membrane, right? And the synovial membrane is not very strong, so there is a reinforcing membrane over it that we call the fibrous capsule, which is more superficial to the synovial membrane. And if we put the fibrous capsule together with the synovial membrane, we get something called the articular capsule. So the articular capsule has got those two divisions. So you could maybe think of the synovial membrane as like being the a serous membrane, right? Here would be like the visceral division. This would be the parietal division of a serous membrane. And that serous membrane does what? Secretes fluid into that cavity, the space, the serous cavity, just like this synovial membrane secretes fluid into the joint cavity right here. And I suppose you could call that a synovial cavity if you wanted to. People would know exactly what you're talking about. All right, so the synovial fluid maintains the health of this hyaline cartilage and provides lubrication. Now this cartilage, if it's damaged, doesn't heal very well because this hyaline cartilage doesn't get enough oxygen and nutrients from the synovial membrane. It would have to be vascular if that were to happen, and hyaline cartilage typically is avascular. So you need to protect the ends of these joints by using just a joint in the way that it's designed to move. And we're going to talk about different motions in just a little bit. All right, so this is a really nice example of a synovial joint because it has all these different components, and then superficial to the articular capsule sometimes are ligaments that span across the joint that help stabilize the joint. So here's a stabilizing ligament that goes from the proximal to the distal bone in this particular joint. Okay, here is just that same example. Hold on. I want to see if I have another example of something right here. No. All right, let's talk about some of the other things that you might find in special joints. So here is a shoulder joint. And here is the glenoid cavity or glenoid fossa. What bone? Three labs have looked at the scapula already. All right, so it's not really a fair question. But what bone has a glenoid cavity? That would be the scapula. So the head of the humerus fits into the glenoid cavity right here. And on covering the head of the humerus, we have what? Articular cartilage, right? Or hyaline cartilage. Lining the glenoid cavity, we have articular cartilage or hyaline cartilage here as well. Here is the joint cavity that contains, what does that contain right here? Synovial fluid. And where does that come from? The synovial membrane that we see right here. And then here is the fibrous capsule, and then the synovial membrane and fibrous capsule put together make the articular capsule. Okay. Well, if you look at the depth of the glenoid cavity, you will notice that it's not very deep, which means that you have a lot of range of motion of the shoulder compared to your hip joint, right? Because the fossa that the hip fits into, that the femur fits into, is very deep. So the hip is a very stable joint. But there is some softer tissue right here and right here that extends right from the margin of the glenoid cavity, which then makes the glenoid cavity a little bit deeper than just the bone, that the impression that you would just get from the bone. Right, so this little tissue that's sticking out from the margin of the glenoid cavity, right, is what we call, it's not labeled. I forgot what it's called. Who knows what that's called? It will come to me in just a second. Oh, it's not coming to me. Hopefully there's another picture. I'll remember what it's called in just a second. Anyway, because it's not bone, it's more like connective tissue. It can be damaged, right? And if it rips away, it can actually then mess up the mechanism of the shoulder joint. Oh, I almost had it. I almost had what it's called. All right, so baseball pitchers rip these things all the time, as you can imagine. And then they have to have it removed. It will, before I'm done, I'm sure I'll remember what this thing is called. I'm sorry? No, nope, that's in your knee. That's a ligament, anterior cruciate ligament. We'll talk about that in a little bit. It's part of rotator cuff. Let's see, do I have it on the sheet right here? I don't have it on the. I should have it right here. I thought it was something I would never forget. Oh, I just had it again, but I forgot. That's too bad. You know how you have something that right on the tip of your tongue and you can't remember? You know what that's like? You know what I think of that's like? It's like bobbing for apples. Have you ever bobbed for an apple? You see those apples floating like in a big pail and you go and try and grab one, and just as you grab it, what happens to it? It moves out of the way. Okay, if I stop thinking, I'm sure I'll remember that. Okay, so here we see that nice shoulder joint and the fibrous capsule around it, and the joint capsule. But here is a tendon that's coming from a pretty powerful muscle, the biceps muscle. And it goes right through that intertubercular groove between the tubercles of the humerus over the head of the humerus, right? So this is moving quite a bit, and it can develop a lot of tension, like you can lift, what, 100 pounds with that biceps right there. And so it puts a lot of tension on the head of the humerus. So there is a special structure that prevents inflammation and reduces friction between this tendon, which is moving a lot, and the humerus that is moving. And so this right here is almost like a little synovial cavity that is surrounding the tendon. It has a fibrous division, it has a synovial membrane, and there's a little cavity on the inside of it filled with synovial fluid. So it's very slippery on the inside. And it surrounds this tendon so that it can move around without causing an inflammation. This is what we call a tendon sheath. So a tendon sheath is like a little lubricated pillow that surrounds this tendon and protects underlying bone, but it could also protect underlying muscle so that it doesn't get inflamed. There's something similar to that called a bursa, right? So a bursa is like a tendon sheath, but it doesn't surround a tendon. It's positioned between maybe a fibrous capsule and a ligament, or between one bone and another bone. And if you look at it, you can see that there is a fibrous capsule with a synovial membrane with synovial fluid on the inside of it. Now, this definitely, to me, looks like a pillow that's really slippery on the inside, and it can slip around, and it protects the head of the humerus and this articular cartilage from the acromion process right here and the subacromial ligament right here whenever you move your shoulder. And these things can become inflamed if you overuse a joint, right? They can swell up, reduce mobility, but it will also hurt very bad. So what do we call an inflammation of a bursa, like the subacromial bursa that's underneath the acromion process, protecting the head of the humerus? That would you would have bursitis, right? And that can be very persistent, and sometimes you need to just not use that joint for a week or two until that bursitis goes away. Some pharmaceutical agents might help, like aspirin or other anti-inflammatories, and worst case, maybe some steroids if that has to go to that degree. All right, so this is not an exam figure, but at least it shows you a nice example of a tendon sheath right here and a bursa, and you have various bursas and tendons in all different places of the body where there is a close association of what? Bones and muscles that rub up against each other. It almost came back to me what that was. Okay. It's not on this diagram right here either. Oh, that's just the same one. Okay. Well, there's one joint that I do want you to know something about. It's not on the practicum. It's going to be on your third practicum, so I'm going to skip over a couple things right here. And, oh, you don't have it on your list. All right, knee. Let's look at some knee figures. And then we're going to go back and talk about some kinds of motions between joints. All right, knee is a very important joint. Well, ankles are real important, elbows are real important, shoulders are real important. But knee is real important. Probably more people have problems with knees than other joints in the body. So let's look at this figure first. All right, so this is a little shocking because this is the first time in this class that we've actually looked at some muscle. There's some muscle superimposed on the knee. So what do we call that body compartment between your knee and your hip? That's your thigh. So these are thigh muscles, and then here is your kneecap. So these thigh muscles, are these anterior thigh muscles or posterior thigh muscles? Anterior thigh muscles. There's four of them, but we can only see three. And since there's four of them, they're called the quadriceps femoris because they're in your thigh. So there are four muscles that insert into the patella. What do we call a muscle-bone connection? That's a tendon. So here is the tendon of the quadriceps that goes to the patella. And then there's some more dense, regular connective tissue that connects the patella to the tibial tuberosity right here. So that's a bone-to-bone connection. What do we call a bone-to-bone connection? That's not a tendon. That is a ligament. And since this is the patella, we call this the patellar ligament. So these muscles stabilize the knee joint via providing tension to the patella, which then provides tension to the tibia via the patellar ligament. And now you can see that the patella is completely surrounded by dense regular connective tissue. So what kind of bone is completely surrounded by either ligaments or tendons? It's called a sesamoid bone. It's a sesamoid bone. You have very few examples of sesamoid bones in your body, and here is one of them. Okay. We see some other ligaments in the knee, right, that go from a superior position to an inferior position, either laterally or medially. And those of you that have lab this afternoon, you're not aware of this yet. Oh yeah, we talked about appendicular skeleton. What is the medial bone in the leg that you have to just memorize? If you don't have that memorized, you got to go home and memorize it really soon. All right? The medial bone is the tibia, and the lateral bone is the fibula. Okay, so there are ligaments that go from the femur down to the fibula, or from the femur down to the tibia, exactly laterally or medially right here. So the one that is lateral is what we call the fibular collateral ligament. It just goes straight up and down. Or you could call this the fibular collateral ligament, right? So this is the lateral or fibular collateral ligament right here. Goes by either name. Here's the one on the other side. This is what you could call the medial collateral ligament or the tibial collateral ligament. And athletes do injure these. You hear that quite frequently, but maybe some other ligaments in the knee are more frequently injured. All right, but this, since it's the tibial collateral ligament, this is a dense connective tissue between what? Since it's a ligament, right here, between two bones, between the femur superiorly and the tibia, okay, inferiorly right here. So on a practicum, you could call this either the tibial collateral ligament or the medial collateral ligament. It's exactly the same thing. All right, so that's some ligaments that I want you to know superficially and tendons superficially on the knee. But we also want to look at some things that are deep inside the knee. So here is another exam figure. I think that previous figure was an exam figure, but here's another one. And we can see some, we can see the interior of the knee and the quadriceps have been removed from this illustration. All right, so here we see condyles of the femur. And this forms an articulation with the tibia right here. So, and this is a freely movable joint. What's a name? What's a scientific name for freely movable? By function. The name of a freely movable joint by function. Diarthrosis. Okay. And this particular joint has all these different components. So by structure, this freely movable joint is called a synovial joint. Synovial joint. And the capsule is removed in the cavity you can't see, in the synovial membrane you can't see, but this is a synovial joint. All right, so what do we know so far? Well, here is the patella, right? That sesamoid bone. Superior to it is the quadriceps tendon, which goes to the quadriceps. Inferiorly attaching to the tibial tuberosity is the patellar ligament. All right, then laterally from the femur to the fibula, here is the fibular collateral ligament, or you could say what, the lateral collateral ligament. Here is the medial collateral ligament right here. These other ones you don't really have to know unless I point them out to you. All right. Now the knee is kind of special because it has some additional fibrocartilage in it, and we call this a meniscus. So it's pretty tough. It helps stabilize the knee and prevents compression. It also protects the articular cartilage on the condyles of the femur and the condyles of the tibia. And if you were to look at these fibrous cartilages right here that we call menisci, you see that there are two. And what letter of the alphabet do they kind of look like? They look like a C. Yeah, so they're nice C-shaped cartilages. You have two of them that fit in your knee just like that. The thickest part of these cartilages, right, is on the exterior rim right here, but also either medially for this, I mean laterally for the lateral meniscus, or medially for the medial meniscus. And as you go to the tip of the C, it also gets very thin. All right, so which is the strongest part of this meniscus? Back here in the middle or over here at the tips? The middle is the strongest because that's the thickest. All right, the part that's the weakest is more at the tips over here, and especially this inside area. So when a meniscus rips and tears, guess where it likes to rip and tear? Kind of at the tips. And since it's thin over here and thicker over here, those tips are actually forming like a wedge, right? And when they break off, for instance, or rip, then those wedges can get stuck in different parts of the knee. And what can typically happen to a knee if it has one of these meniscal wedges floating around in there? What do we do to doors sometimes if we want to prop it open? We stick a little wedge underneath the door. All right, so a knee can lock up pretty easily. You lose mobility if you have that little wedge moving around in there and gets wedged between different parts, different structures inside the knee. And then, of course, you need some surgery to remove that torn meniscus or that wedge that's just floating around in there completely. Years ago, when a meniscus was damaged, surgeons would remove the whole meniscus, thinking that would be best for the knee. But why is this meniscus in the knee to begin with? To protect the articular cartilages, right, on the femur and the tibia. And eventually, when you don't have a meniscus right there, that cartilage gets ground away, destroyed, so then you have bone touching bone, grinding each other away. And what do we call that condition? When you no longer have cartilage, articular cartilage, and you have bones touching each other. What do we call that? That's arthritis, right? And so that's not really good. So now surgeons really plan the surgery. They move as little of the meniscus as possible, but yet maintain protection and range of motion for the individual. Okay. All right, so the two bones in the leg, which one is medial? Which one is lateral? Which one is medial? That tibia. And you can palpate the tibia, right? So I don't have an easy way to remember which one is medial and which one is lateral, but fortunately, you'll bring one to the test with you, probably two, right? And you can just palpate your leg, and you can feel that big, strong tibia, and that's going to be the medial bone. The fibula, which is lateral, you can't feel because it's surrounded with so much muscle. All right, so you can go ahead and cheat on the test and palpate your leg to remember which one is medial. So this right here, sometimes we call this the medial collateral ligament. Here's the medial meniscus because it matches up with the tibia right here. And the one over here, this is the fibular or what? Lateral collateral ligament. Okay. And then here is the lateral meniscus because it's lining up with the fibula. All right, there's only two other structures in the knee that I want you to know something about. And it's these two ligaments right here. And look at that. One starts out posterior and moves anteriorly. There's another that starts out anteriorly and it moves posteriorly. So what are those two ligaments doing? And a ligament is what? A bone-to-bone connection between the femur and the tibia right here. What do we call a bone-to-bone connection again? That's a ligament. So what do? They cross over each other. So typically when things cross over each other in anatomy, we call that a cruciate. Right, association. So here is, these are the two cruciate ligaments. Somebody mentioned that in class already. That's fairly well known in common day language. Here is the anterior cruciate ligament, which is anterior. Here is the posterior cruciate ligament that you can see inserts into the tibia posteriorly. And these come from that notch, the intercondylar notch in the femur, and they insert into that bump between the condyles of the tibia. Does anybody remember what that bump between the condyles of the tibia is called? That is anterior. Here's the tibial tuberosity right here. But here's the condyle, right? Here's a lateral condyle. Here's a medial condyle of the tibia. And in between, there's a bump right there. I don't think I want to take time to flip to the previous chapter to show you a slide. But that's called the intercondylar eminence on the tibia, right between the condyles. And so that is like a process for attachment of the cruciate ligaments. All right, so this is a really good exam figure. And on the third practicum, you'll have to know this on models. We have some good models in lab as well. But it's a joint that is commonly injured, so it's a really good joint to know a lot about. Okay. And it has tendon sheaths and bursa as well. Let's see if I can show you where some of those are. Oh, there's some nice pictures. Just different views. Oh, here's kind of a lateral projection. Here you can see the cruciate ligaments. Here's the patella. Okay, so here's the suprapatellar bursa. This is not an exam figure, but this is just to reinforce concepts of what a bursa is. It's protecting things that move or really pound up against each other, like really powerful muscles, the quadriceps muscles, and the femur right here, so the bursa absorbs that shock. Here's the deep infrapatellar bursa, right? Infrapatellar means what, below the patella. Here's the prepatellar bursa. Prepatellar means in front of the patella, which again protects the moat because this patella moves around quite a bit. All right, here you can see like a little wedge-shaped aspect of a meniscus. Okay. Let's talk about some motions. This is going to make the class a lot easier to talk about various motions. So let's go back to some of these previous things right here. Because it's hard to talk anatomy without knowing some basic definitions. All right. Motions. Let's talk about these motions right here. Special motions of the body. We got to go back and talk about a couple different things. And in Blackboard, I think you have some nice animations that actually demonstrate what some of these motions are, but some of these still motions aren't too bad. So let's talk about a simple kind of motion first, right, which is an angular movement, like flexion and extension. All right, so here are two motions. Let's think of a joint, and the bones on either side of the joint can make a straight line, like your elbow. All right, so the bones of my forearm and the bones of my arm right here just make a straight line. I can decrease the angle between these two bones by doing this. So this is 180 degrees when it's straight. What's this? 90 degrees is less. The angle is decreasing. What is this angle? That's even less, like 30, 35 degrees, something like that. So when you decrease the angle between two bones, we call that flexion. But you can also go the other way. You can make the angle between two bones greater. We call that extension. So flexion and extension are nice opposite motions, right? And that's probably really important in this class because those two motions in opposition are what we call what? Antagonistic to each other. So what's your impression of antagonism? Do you like to be around friends that are antagonistic to you all the time? No, it's the drag, right? So there's usually really bad connotations to antagonism. But in terms of physiology and anatomy, it's a very important point, and antagonism provides for precise control and balance, right? So it's the most important concept in physiology and anatomy right here, antagonism, and it's a good thing, okay? And why is that? Well, because you have a biceps that can flex the forearm, and you have a triceps that can extend the forearm at the elbow joint. What do you have with this finger right here? Precise control and balance. If you only had a muscle to cause flexion, right, what were to happen if last Friday, if that person with a fancy blue uniform and a badge and sidearm pulled you over and said, with your eyes closed, take your fingertip and put it on your nose. If you only had a biceps, what would happen to this index finger? Well, it could you would maybe poke yourself in the eye. Right? Or you could maybe poke yourself in the nose, which is what they're asking, or you maybe even hit the officer with your finger. All right? What else do you need besides the biceps to have precise control of where your hand and finger is going? Not only do you need something to cause it to flex, you need something that will moderate that motion, namely the triceps, right, that controls how fast it moves and where it moves. So antagonism is a very important concept. So here is the first skeletal example of why antagonism is important. Let's relate this to your automobile. What do you have in your automobile? Two mechanisms that are antagonistic to each other, but you would never think of driving your automobile without those two things that work in opposition to each other. Your brake and your gas pedal, right? So antagonism is real important for precise control and balance of your car. If you only had a gas pedal, after work, you could hit your gas pedal and drive home. Well, what would happen when you got home? Well, you could only wave goodbye. You couldn't stop, right? So why even bother driving home? You need those antagonistic mechanisms for precise control and balance. All right, so that's flexion and extension. You can do that with your fingers. What motion is this? I'm decreasing the angle between the phalanges of my digits. Here is making the angle bigger. So here we have flexion and extension. You can flex at the wrist and extend at the wrist. You can also do this at the wrist. We call that hyperextension. All right, so you got flexion, extension, hyperextension. Some joints you can hyperextend, other joints you can't because you might break something. It all depends on the nature of how that joint is put together. Okay. All right, here's another one. A little bit more confusing than flexion and extension, but they are still antagonistic to each other. It's abduction and adduction. Maybe this is an example here. Let's see what this says. Oh no, those are gliding motions. Let's put that away. Adduction, abduction. I would like probably this one right here. Okay. Abduction is when you take a body part and you move it toward midline. like when you have your arms out to your side and you bring them to midline like that. That is adduction. So you're doing what? You're adding your appendages to your body. You do that with your legs, adduction, bring your feet together. You can do that with your fingers. When you bring your fingers together, that is adduction. All right, so opposite that is what? When you spread your fingers out, abduction. When you raise your arms away from your body, that's abduction, right? And when you move your legs apart like that, that is abduction. And again, you have different muscles controlling those, so that gives you precise control and balance via what? Antagonism. Certain joints are really nice because they can do a number of different motions at one time. Like your shoulder can abduct and adduct. It can flex and extend, and it can do combinations of all of those different things. Right? It can do like a windmill motion. That's what we call circumduction. So some joints you can circumduct with, like your hip and your shoulder, they have enough degrees of freedom to do that. So circumduction, we can see circumduction right here. Rotation of a bone around its long axis. Like there are two vertebrae that can rotate around each other, like between C1 and C2, because C2 has a dens, C1 can rotate around it. So what do we call this motion? Lateral rotation, or you could say no, right? But it's really a lateral rotation, right lateral rotation, left lateral rotation. So it's just a 180 degree kind of rotation. Other bones that you can rotate, right, is your humerus. Right, you can rotate your humerus like this. My forearm is moving. You can see my hand and my forearm moving. All right, but maybe if I bend my elbow like this, okay, and keep my radius and ulna nice and parallel to each other, this is, all right, I'm not moving the ulna and radius. I'm not moving anything in my hand, my wrist. The only bone that's moving is what? Is the humerus. It's rotating within the shoulder joint. So that's a rotation, lateral rotation, medial rotation at the shoulder joint. So that's pretty important. These are all good motions to know. Somebody mentioned rotator cuff up in the back of the room when we were talking about bursas. All right, a rotator cuff injury is an injury of the shoulder joint, and there are a number of muscles that actually are integral parts of the joint capsule or fibrous capsule of the shoulder. And when you damage one of those muscles, it has a tendency to damage the joint capsule, and it inhibits the way that you can rotate the humerus. So a really good, simple way to diagnose whether somebody has a rotator cuff tear is by telling somebody to, what's this motion called? That's flexion and extension. So flex at the elbow, okay? And then try to do a lateral rotation. Resist just a simple lateral rotation. So maybe have their place their hand by their belly button and see if they can move their hand outward like that, perform a lateral rotation. And if they try to do that and you kind of scream in agony, then you know that's a rotator cuff tear. Really nice, simple diagnosis. Okay. All right, some other kinds of motions. Supination and pronation. This is of the forearm. And you probably have something that looks like that in here. No, that's rotation. But I'll just show you what it is. Am I going the right way?
Yeah.
Yeah? No? Yeah, I don't see it. Okay, I'll show you what it is. Let's start with anatomic position. One more?
Yeah. Oh.
That's how I am asking for directions. If I just would have gone another block, I wouldn't have had to stop for directions. Okay. Okay, supination and pronation. Start with anatomic position. This is always important. Which way are the palms of your hands facing? Anteriorly, so your thumbs are lateral. Okay. Now you can move so that the palms of your hands are facing posteriorly. Now I didn't rotate my humerus, I just crossed over, right, the ulna and the radius. So the palms of the hands are facing posteriorly. We call that pronation. So going from here to here is pronation. Palms of the hands posterior, pronation. And when the palms move from posterior to anterior, we call that supination. So those are the two things. That's when the bones of the forearm cross over each other or straighten out back parallel. So how can you remember that? Pronation posterior for the palms. But also when you're supinated, what do your, if you flex your fingers a little bit and bring your hands together, what does that make? That makes a soup bowl, which is what? supination. All right, so that's easy to remember that. Okay, what else we got right here? Dorsiflexion, plantar flexion. That was somewhere really close. I saw that here somewhere. Yeah, here it is. Okay. All right, so we said at the wrist, right, this is flexion, right, and this is extension, and this is hyperextension. Now, if you look at your upper appendage and compare it to your lower appendage, the arrangement of these bones and muscles and the motions that they undergo is really different, right? So if you flex at the elbow, which way does your hand move? Posteriorly or anteriorly? When you flex at the elbow, which way does it move? Anteriorly. But if you flex at the knee, okay, which way does your foot go? Posteriorly, right? So the joints are kind of twisted around a little bit. So the motion of the ankle is really strange if you think about your hand. So it's best not even to think about how it works on your hand, because you'd really have to do some strange motions. So you can lift your toes up off the ground, right? Or you could point your toes into the ground, either up or down. Both of those motions are what we call flexion. So there is no extension at the ankle. So when you lift your toes up off the ground, we call that dorsiflexion, because it's like pointing your toes to the back, dorsiflexion. And when you point your toes into the ground, we call that plantar flexion, like trying to plant your toes into the ground. So both are flexion. Dorsi is lifting your toes up. Plantar is pointing your toes into the ground. But not really moving your digits, moving what? Your ankle around this axis right here. Okay. That's real important, motion. You know, years ago, when you went to see a doctor, you'd walk into the room, doctor would be sitting there, and as you walked in the room, a doctor could just pretty much make a diagnosis, right? Because he could see how you walked and what you looked like and how you said hi and that kind of stuff. Nowadays, you don't have time to do that. Everybody's placed in a room and a doctor just runs from one room to another and hardly sees a patient, which is too bad. So why is that important about even just watching how somebody walks? You can diagnose spinal cord injuries, all right? But you can sort of do that by looking at the tips of somebody's shoes, all right? And what do you have to do to when you're walking to raise the tip of your shoe off the ground? What's that motion called? Dorsiflexion, right? So you have to lift your toes up like that. But if you can't do that motion, what do your toes do? If you can't lift your toes up and you're walking, you're dragging the toes of your shoes over the ground and they wear out in the front. Okay? So which means you can't dorsiflex, which usually means some kind of spinal cord injury. Right? Because you're losing control to the muscles that lift your toes up off the ground. But what are the consequences of that? In our age group, it's not such a big deal. But think of your grandma or grandpa. What does that mean if they can't lift their toes off the ground? They're going to trip, and what's a bone that usually breaks when you trip? Hip bone. And what are some of the consequences of that? It's a major problem, right? They have to go to a convalescence home. They're away from their family, away from their familiar surroundings, and a lot of times people just give up the will to live right when that happens to them. So just by looking at somebody's shoes, you can save somebody's life in that respect, right? And that's because of this dorsiflexion. So it's really important to know all of these different kinds of motions. Plantar flexion, don't forget, is when you point your toes into the ground. So, as a matter of fact, even if you take one of your pets to see a veterinarian, like a dog or something, they'll even look at toenails to see if the tips of their toenails are ground down, because, again, that could mean spinal cord injuries. Okay, eversion has to do with the ankle, but more of a lateral kind of motion. So let's see if we have here's a pretty good picture of inversion and eversion. So here's the axis of rotation, right? When you try to stand on, this is what we call the lateral malleolus of your ankle, right? And this is the easiest way to twist your ankle. Only people in the front can see, but if you try to stand on your lateral malleolus like that, that is an inversion. There aren't a lot of ligaments that prevent that kind of motion, so that's the easiest way to sprain an ankle. And if you move the other way, trying to stand on your medial malleolus, right, that's what we call eversion at the ankle. And I could probably run around on either of these malleoli right here because I've sprained my ankle so many times playing all kinds of different sports. But unfortunately, when you stretch a ligament, it always has a tendency to then stay stretched out. You just have to be careful. And how do you get strength back to a joint once it's these ligaments are stretched out? You get the muscles on either side of the joint as strong as possible. That's what then can restabilize that joint. Okay, so that's inversion, eversion. Protraction and retraction. What the heck does that look like? I think we have maybe an example here. You can do this with your jaw, but don't chip a tooth. You can take your mandible and you can jet it out forward, right? That is protraction, or you can move it back in to your skull. That is retraction. You can do that with your shoulders as well. You can protract or you can retract your shoulders. There's something else you can do with your shoulders. You can elevate and depress. And you can do the same thing with your mandible. You can depress your mandible and you can elevate your mandible like that. So the mandible is kind of, or the TMJ is an interesting joint. So you can do all kinds of motions with it. You can elevate, depress, protract, retract, and you can even grind from side to side. And so that TMJ joint is another joint that is similar to the knee in that it has a meniscus in it. It has some fibrocartilage within the joint capsule. All right, and then another kind of motion is opposition. All right, so what do we, with the fingers, what do we call this motion when you spread your fingers out like that? That is abduction. And when you move them together again, that is adduction. So here's abduction, adduction. So I'm doing that with my thumb, right? But there's something else you can do with your thumb. You can move it anteriorly and then oppose the rest of your fingers. So that's what we call opposition, right, at the thumb. So there's a special joint in there that we'll be interested in just a little bit. All right, so those are important motions. So now I'll be able to use some of these terms when talking about bones, and especially when we start looking at muscles that move those bones around. So understand these motions and even look maybe at some videos or something online for that. Okay, so then lastly, different joints can produce different kinds of motions, right? Flexion, extension, maybe rotation. So if a joint can perform, if we have two joints, one is can perform a rotation and the other can perform flexion and extension, right? So the function of those joints is different. Guess what that means? The function of those joints is different. The internal structure of those joints are different so that it can perform different kinds of motion. So joints that can perform circumduction, for instance, are going to be a lot different than joints that can just flex and extend. We call those hinge joints. All right, so let's look at some joints. Some allow very little freedom. We call that a gliding kind of joint or a plane joint. And those are joints between, right, the bones of the wrist. So these are flat joints. So there's a little bit of motion, maybe right and left, right, or anterior posteriorly. So we call this a gliding joint or a plane joint because that's just a nice plane right here. There is no axis of motion. It's just like two plates slipping on top of each other. That's one kind of joint. Another kind of joint is a hinge joint. And here we see a nice joint between the humerus and the ulna. Anybody remember what this condylar surface is called? Sooner or later you're going to know that. That's the trochlea. And then here's the ulna. What do we call this notch in the ulna? That is the trochlear notch that accepts, right, that fits right inside the trochlea right here. And this joint is a pure hinge joint, which means you can only flex and extend at that joint. And if you take that joint and you try to do something else with it, like if you try to bend your forearm medially at that elbow joint, or you try to bend it laterally, all right, at that joint, then something's going to break terribly. What do we call it if at the elbow you tried to move it medially toward midline? Adduction. The elbow cannot adduct, right? And the elbow can't abduct, right? It shouldn't do that. And if it performs that motion, then something's going to break. It's purely a hinge joint between the ulna, right, the trochlear notch and the trochlea. And it's what we call a uniaxial joint, right? It can only flex and extend. All right, a condyloid joint. Let's see if we have a nice example. Oh, here's a pivot joint. Okay, here's a condyloid joint between a metacarpal and the phalanges. And so what can you do with this joint right here? So that's a joint between your digits and your hand. What can you do with that joint? You can flex, you can extend, maybe hyper, I can't anymore, but some people, if you play the piano or something, right, you can hyperextend maybe a little bit if you have nice mobility. But what else can you do? It's not just a hinge joint. What else can you do at that joint? You can abduct and adduct, right? So there are two axes of motion right there. So it's what we call biaxial motion. All right, so that's what we call a condyloid joint right here, not just purely flexion and extension. A saddle joint is even more complicated. All right, it's a multiaxial kind of motion. So between the first metacarpal, which metacarpal is number one? That's your thumb, okay? And a carpal. So what can you do with that joint? Really interesting. All right, you can certainly flex and extend, but you can also opposition with that joint, right? So you can flex, extend, adduct, abduct, as well as opposition. So there, this is what we call multi-axial motion with a saddle joint. And then we have a ball and socket joint, which is the most complicated. A good example would be the head of the humerus and the glenoid cavity of the scapula, or the head of the femur. And what does the head of the femur articulate with? The acetabulum. So those of you that have lab this afternoon, you'll see that. All right, so another example of a multi-axial joint right here would be a ball and socket. And so you can do circumduction with your shoulder or your hip joint. Okay. And the last one that we haven't talked about yet is a pivot joint. A good example of a pivot joint. All right, we said between C1 and C2. All right, but here's another good example between the head of the radius and the notch in the ulna. Anybody remember what this notch in the ulna is called? Remember, this is the ulna. You don't name the notch after the bone that it's on. You name it after the bone that articulates with it. So this is the radial notch, or you could call that the radial fossa if you wanted to. And here's a nice transverse ligament that holds the head of the radius in position right here. So the head of the radius can rotate or pivot in that area for what kind of motion? Let's check this out. What motion is that? That is pronation, and this is supination, right? So the head of the radius is turning within the radial notch within the ulna right here. Okay, so that is a uniaxial motion. That's a nice pivot joint. Okay, so we're going to be using all of this terminology, all these different motions. Definitely learn that one. And guess what? This is it for the next test. So even though the next test isn't until a week from Wednesday, this is it. We're going to carry on with lecture. But I don't like to have the lecture exam so far away from the end of lecture, but we have the practicums coming. I didn't want to have a practicum and lecture exam on the same day. All right, so keep working your pre-lecture reading assignments. That's really important. I think that helps a lot in terms of listening and understanding what's going on in lecture. Any questions at all? Up to this point, we'll be on the next exam. And then we're going to start, I think, muscles on Wednesday.